today, how the Grenfell Tower fire triggered a crisis which has led to thousands being trapped in flats they cannot sell. Across the country, thousands of people are caught up in a building safety crisis.
My name's Will.
My name's Paul.
I live in Hackney in London.
I am a leaseholder of a property in Sheffield.
The problem with our building is that it has a timber frame.
We have got ACM cladding.
All in all, last year cost me £12,000, so that included the waking watch.
Missing cavity barriers and insulation, which never met regulations at the time of construction.
£1,000 in extra insurance costs.
No mortgage company, no bank would lend to a buyer with a building with cladding.
Essentially, we've been told that the building should never have been signed off.
What it effectively meant was that my flat was worth nothing.
And then we got a massive bill. It came up to nearly 80 to 90 grand.
There's nights where we wake up in the middle of the night just thinking about costs.
A life where I can't sell my flat, I can't remortgage my flat.
The best case scenario is
12 months of worry.
Just get on with our lives as normal, like we thought we would, like everyone else does.
Living in a flat which could be dangerous.
I don't really see a way out at the moment.
After the Grenfell fire tragedy in June 2017, it became clear that buildings all over England were potentially unsafe. 4 years later, and we still don't know for sure how many people are affected. But those that are say it is ruining their lives and that they need more help from the government. Yesterday, that help was announced, but many feel it does little to help them out of a situation that is preventing them from moving forward in their lives. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, 4 years on from Grenfell, who is responsible for making buildings fire safe? Rob Booth, you are the social affairs correspondent for The Guardian, and let's start this with the disaster that set all of this in motion, the Grenfell Tower fire. Can you remind us of the factors that led to that happening?
Well, the most obvious thing on the night of the fire and in the immediate aftermath was that the cladding was burning ferociously and the flames seemed to be spreading through the cladding.
Cladding was a key issue at Grenfell. The building's outer skin was an aluminium composite material. That's quite common. You rainproof the building with thin sheets of aluminium bound around a core of some kind. But, as Newsnight revealed, the core at Grenfell was polyethylene, a plastic, one of the less fireproof core types. That may have let the fire spread.
And then what we found out later and over the subsequent years, it's been 4 years now since the Grenfell fire, was that the global construction industry had for quite a long time been pushing the use of more plastic materials, cheaper plastic materials in cladding and insulation.
A new industry has sprung up, offering methods of repairing the systems. Tower blocks hundreds of feet high are being completely recovered or reclad in new materials, guaranteed to prevent rain reaching the joints.
And the idea was essentially to sort of drive down costs, but also to improve the insulation of buildings. And that big push was a sort of way of finding a new outlet for petroleum-based products, I think, in some way, even though they were combustible.
What sort of risks do you think there are from using systems that haven't been appraised properly?
Well, to take a very obvious one, there's the fire risk, and I think it's absolutely essential that anything that is being placed on or around an existing block should be considered very carefully in relation to a serious fire.
Do you think that there are now systems being used which represent a fire risk?
Frankly, yes.
So, you know, these fires that we saw raging on Grenfell weren't the first fires using these kind of materials that we'd seen. So they'd been happening in Australia. There'd been fires in the Middle East in high-rise blocks. There'd been fires in Europe in high-rise blocks using these similar cladding and insulation materials. And yet, you know, these materials were still being used widely in the UK.
A lot of what we've learned about this cladding at Grenfell has come out at the Grenfell inquiry, which began a few months after the disaster. And I remember when the fire happened, the word cladding felt very new to a lot of us. But when did it become clear that it was on many more buildings around the country?
It was literally in the days after Grenfell, it started to emerge that other council blocks had the same material on it.
Government officials are scrambling to ID fire hazards in at least 10 other buildings in the wake of last week's deadly Grenfell blaze.
There was a scramble, obviously. You know, all the councils were running around sort of lifting the corners of the building facades and trying to see what they'd got.
Residents were ordered to leave this public housing high-rise in North London over mounting concerns about exposed gas pipes and combustible exterior cladding.
I mean, and it was only about 10 days after Grenfell that Camden Council in London decided to evacuate over 1,000 residents from a series of towers on its Chalcotts estate. I mean, these residents were having to sort of put up in a leisure centre, and at this point we didn't really know how wide it was going to go, but obviously it wasn't going to be a tightly limited crisis. And by the end of June 2017, we'd already found that 95 buildings had the same cladding. I mean, we now know lots more, but that was just within a couple of weeks.
And how has this developed? I mean, this story has moved beyond cladding in many ways, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah, I mean, it absolutely has. And the way it's developed has been somewhat chaotic because people were sort of stripping material off and then finding underneath there was a greater cause for concern. So it started to seem like, okay, how many layers of the onion do we need to keep peeling back until we get to a safe building? People in the buildings were obviously very concerned. Landlords and councils were sort of panicking about it, I think, and the numbers just kept rising. So by the end of the year, it had gone up to 300 high-rises, that's buildings over 18 metres, that had been found to be one way or other in breach of building regulations. And then there were lots of other things that it wasn't just the cladding, it wasn't just the insulation, there were missing fire breaks, there were timber balconies, fire doors started to emerge as a problem, that they were inadequate.
The cladding was just one part of the problem, compounded by flammable insulation and missing fire breaks.
This then was a growing problem that cut across so many industries. Who was responsible in the first instance for trying to solve this huge issue?
Well, in the first instance, the housing secretary was Sajid Javid.
I mean, something, let's be very clear, I mean, from day one, I've said this, is that something went massively wrong that night. It was horrific what happened. It should never have happened in a country like ours, one of the richest in the world in the 21st century. That should not be happening. So something has absolutely gone wrong.
And he said, this is about 12 days after the fire, he said it was a catastrophic failure of building regulations. So that maybe it was the government that was responsible. But actually, while there's truth in that, the issue really fell to the social housing landlords, the council landlords. They had the immediate responsibility to get the stuff off. And then pretty quickly, it became apparent that actually the private blocks were being affected as well. And so that led to a much more complicated situation where it wasn't just a landlord's responsibility. You had this leaseholder-freeholder relationship where the leaseholder owns the flat, the freeholder owns the freehold of the whole building, and the responsibility has fallen into the gap between those two parties, and they would not agree on who should pay.
What changes were introduced to try and improve fire safety?
Well, I mean, the first thing was loads of residents, you know, ended up putting up with emergency measures. So you had, you know, in some cases, there were fire engines stationed nearby to buildings with this cladding. Lots of buildings had these 24-hour waking watch patrols of the corridors, many of which are still continuing. People started to panic about bins being set on fire close to cladding. So bin stores were being kind of relocated. And then in Whitehall, they announced a review of the whole building regulations, which was undertaken by a woman called Dame Judith Hackett. But she said that combustible materials themselves shouldn't be banned. She was essentially kind of coming back to the point that if used in the right design, then they have the potential to be safe. But that was very difficult for kind of the government to sell as an idea and for the public to understand. And so the government wanted something clearer at that point. And it announced that it planned to ban combustible cladding on buildings over 80 metres. And that's what has subsequently happened.
Although combustible materials have been banned on new buildings, and the government has pledged billions to have it removed from others across the country, there are still thousands of people living with it on their homes. Like Natalie, who is a private leaseholder of a flat in New Providence Wharf in East London.
I mean, it's a beautiful location. It's on the river. It's a really lovely flat. And I had upgraded from a one bed, and here it's a two bath, two bed, so with a balcony, and just really, really loved it. It was sort of dream come true flat, really.
And your building, Natalie's, owned and managed by a company called Ballymore. When did you first realise that your home was covered in the same flammable material as Grenfell was?
It was probably about 6 months after Grenfell that we found out. Ballymore then met with us, with the residents, and so we began our discussions and negotiations with them about how swiftly the work could be done, and naturally then who would end up paying for it. At the time, they estimated the costs at being somewhere between $2 and $2.5 million. They were only prepared to contribute $500K, which we thought was outrageous given that they were the developer, the freeholder and the managing agent. And this is not a problem, obviously, that we knew about or have any control over. It's all utterly within the control of Ballymore.
So when you got it confirmed from Ballymore that there was cladding on the building, you learned two things at once, essentially. One, that your building had the dangerous flammable cladding that was on Grenfell. And two, that it was going to cost you, the leaseholder, a lot of money if you wanted to get it taken off.
Yes. Yes. It just seemed utterly outrageous. It still seems utterly outrageous.
You're a leaseholder, which means the flat is yours and you can do what you want to it, but you have to pay service charges for the whole building. This goes towards things like fixing lifts when they break, but it's also the way that freeholders are recouping costs for making buildings fire safe, which is leading to huge bills for leaseholders like yourself. How much more are you paying now?
In my circumstance here at New Providence Wharf, our service charges have gone up 53% in the last 4 years. Since Grenfell.
Gosh, are you able to give me a sense of what that is in actual monetary terms?
Yes, yes. So now at end of December, my service charge was up to 8,000 a year. And I'm expecting that to go up another 2 grand to 10,000 a year when we get the bill this month, because we now have to pay for Waking Watch as well.
Rob, you've reported on the enormous bills people like Natalie are being saddled with to pay to make their buildings safe, even before the cladding has been removed. What have leaseholders told you about how this is impacting on them?
Well, you can count the ways, really. The first thing, I think, is the financial shock, which is for people who are working people who are suddenly faced with a bill that's in the tens of thousands of pounds. They simply can't afford it. So it has an immediate impact on their financial planning and a huge impact on decisions that they're going to make around having children.
We wanted to start a family, but we can't start a family. We're trapped in the situation.
About changing jobs, about moving, all of these things are frozen by the bill that they're saddled with.
You feel like you're living in a nightmare every day, and it's got to a point where you genuinely would not wish this on your worst enemy.
And there's a massive mental health impact. I mean, the campaign groups that have formed to challenge the situation have audited the mental health impact.
It's not really something I can switch off from. It's all consuming, and I feel like I've almost got two jobs at the moment.
People who are suffering severe depression, people who are turning to drink, people have had suicidal ideation as a result of the stress that this is causing them. It's chronic, so it's been going on for years, and there is no end in sight. So the pressure on the people who are kind of really affected by this is really hard to grasp unless you're living through it, I think.
I've had a very close friend, and I was trying to reassure her about her cladding, and I hope she doesn't mind me sharing this. She had a heart attack on Thursday. It's the stress of living in this cladding.
Do we know, does the government know, how many people are affected by this?
Well, this is a contentious point, but I think that if we just build the figures up, so if you just take the high-rise buildings over 18 metres, we think there's about 2,000 of those which are affected. So that is about 150,000 households right there. And then if you take into account lower-rise blocks, it's possible that there's over 1 million flats that could be unmortgageable at the moment, simply because they can't prove that they're safe.
I mean, it's kind of unreal how many people are caught up in this. We spoke earlier about what the government initially did to make buildings fire safe after Grenfell. As this issue has grown, what else have they offered to help leaseholders?
Well, there's been a couple of things. They've focused purely on buildings that have got cladding problems.
Well, what we've done is focus taxpayers' money, £5 billion, with expert advice on the material that is most dangerous and the type of building that's highest risk.
So they've done a loan scheme for people who live in buildings that are under 18 metres that have got defective cladding. And they've done a grant scheme for people who are living in buildings that are over 18 metres. And that's so leaseholders can afford to pay for the works that the developers or the freeholders aren't paying.
And how helpful is that to a lot of leaseholders?
Well, the grant scheme potentially is helpful because if the grants are approved, then they don't have to pay. The loan scheme, of course, is a loan. So it's the cost is still falling on the leaseholders. So none of this has delivered a kind of quick and easy solution.
Yesterday, the Building Safety Bill was published. Does that offer any more help for leaseholders?
The Building Safety Bill has been like hotly awaited. I mean, there was a draft form of this in 2020, and this was really kind of the great hope for leaseholders that the government might use this piece of legislation to solve this crisis. And what we've seen is that it's not going to do that. And leaseholders are digesting this very fact this week, because what it's going to do is it's going to enshrine in legislation the ability of freeholders and developers to pass on the costs, not to protect the leaseholders, but actually to allow them to pass on the costs as long as those developers have made efforts to try and find other ways first of covering those costs. The other aspect of what the bill is proposing to do is to give leaseholders the right, or to extend their right, to sue the developers on buildings which have got this defective cladding and wall systems. If a bit, you know, this can go back 15 years, so retroactively they can sue developers. So effectively that means that, you know, any buildings constructed after 2006, 2007, whenever the bill goes through, that will change, will be able to sue. Problem is, large numbers of the buildings were built before 2006, so they won't come under that new piece of legislation. And if they do, and some do, some leaseholders may be able to sue, they don't have the money to establish the legal case.
And it's going to be very, very expensive for them. So it sounds much, much better than it is.
Well, I don't think there's any easy way out of this situation. You're absolutely right. I want the developers, the builders, the warranty companies, the insurers, to pay up. I want shoddy workmanship to be paid for by the people who did it, not by the leaseholders. This new change in the law, I think, does put new cards in the hands of the leaseholders so they can take action.
So it hasn't been welcomed particularly by leaseholders, because it doesn't seem to be a useful tool for them.
Yes, so not really particularly helpful for leaseholders. How have they responded to this bill since it came out yesterday?
Sort of crushing disappointment, actually. They had hoped, as I said, that this is something that would get them closer to solving this problem. But what they've realised is that the kind of the passing of the buck will continue, that it doesn't, the bill does not do anything to sort of determine clearly who is responsible. The government continues to say, and Robert Jenrick, the housing secretary, continues to say that it's wrong that leaseholders should pay and that it's wrong that taxpayers should pay and that the people who should be paying are the developers who constructed these faulty buildings. But that's not what the legislation is going to say. And, you know, people I've been speaking to about this week are, you know, saying in terms that can't really be broadcast how disappointed they are about this. And, you know, you can hear the anguish they feel.
Mm. And I'm sure for many of them, it feels like a lot of more of the same. Is there a chance, though, that there are some aspects of this bill that could be amended as it goes through Parliament?
The publication of the bill will probably trigger a new political fight in Parliament. So Labour have said that they're going to try and generate a cross-party consensus to defeat these aspects of the bill and amend them in order to give leaseholders protection. It's not something that the leaseholders are particularly looking forward to. Earlier this year, a very similar process happened on a different bill called the Fire Safety Bill, where again, amendments from some Conservative rebels and Labour and others tried to get protections in there for leaseholders and ultimately failed because clearly the government has a fairly heavy majority at the moment. So, yes, there will be another fight almost certainly over this in the Houses of Parliament. But the hopes of the government being defeated are probably slim.
Robert, do you ever think it might take another fire like the one at Grenfell to persuade the government to bring in legislation that takes the financial burden of this off leaseholders?
Well, I mean, that is the constant fear and to some extent the surprise has been that we haven't had another fire that has led to loss of life caused by the same problems 4 years on. There have been incidents, near misses, in that time, though, and they have been fires in Bolton, there's been fires in East London, which have involved combustible materials on the outsides of buildings, which have been close, you know, to costing lives and have caused injuries. And they don't seem to have moved the needle particularly in terms of the speed with which the government is addressing this. The fear of the Grenfell families in particular is that they will wake up one day and see that Grenfell 2 has happened. And for them to have gone through 4 years of campaigning and to feel that this issue that wrecked their lives has still not been solved is very, very painful.
Despite the fact that cladding was found on Natalie's building months after Grenfell, by May of this year, the debate over who should pay for its removal continued. While her building qualified for the government grant scheme because it is over 18 metres, that still didn't cover the full cost. And then on the morning of May the 7th, the thing that she and her neighbours had dreaded for so long actually happened.
I think the fire started at around 9:15. I was on a work call at the time, and I found out about the fire through our residents' WhatsApp group. So we have no audible alarms. We have no sprinkler system. So I just happened to notice that my WhatsApp was going nuts, just floods and floods of messages coming through. So I opened it up and it said fire in Block D. And I asked the question, does that mean that they're evacuating Block D or the whole building? And I was told just to get out and get out now.
Sorry, Natalie, can I just stop you there? You said no audible alarms. What other alarms are there?
It's a good question. So we have within our individual flats, we have smoke detectors. But the building itself, there are no audible alarms. So there is no means. When this fire started, nobody knew. You know, as I say, I only exited the building because WhatsApp told me to. By the time I got out, fire engines were already here. There were people who remained in the building all day and just had no idea that this was going on outside.
Flames climbing up a London tower block, a block still covered in the same type of flammable cladding as Grenfell Tower.
The 8th, 9th and 10th floors of the 19-storey tower block burned throughout the morning.
So the fire spread upwards, started on the 8th floor. It was an electrical fault in a fuse box, spread through the flat onto the balcony, and then then set fire to the next two flats above it, so to the 9th and 10th floors.
Now the key thing to say, of course, is that no serious injuries or any deaths. But there is a lot of anger from residents that I've been speaking to today.
It took a number of hours for the London Fire Brigade to extinguish the fire. And then that's when things got very strange, because it transpires, you know, and that we've had the London Fire Brigade report. It turns out that the smoke detection system failed, the ventilation shafts failed, the staircase, which is the escape route, filled with toxic smoke, the fire doors failed, the fire department's lift failed, and it meant that there were people trapped in the building for over an hour before the fire department were able to get them out. We could see and hear people screaming from their balconies. There is one flat, two people ended up in hospital. We were very fortunate that there were no fatalities. But one of the guys who ended up in hospital, his flat doesn't have a balcony, so he was unable to take refuge on the balcony, which meant he passed out from the toxic smoke. Just really, really terrifying that 4 years on from Grenfell, we can be in a position where we don't have audible alarms, we don't have a sprinkler system. All of the measures that were put in place for our safety all failed. The waking watch that we're paying a fortune for couldn't get above the 7th floor. So we're just furious because, you know, this can happen again. It just doesn't feel that any lessons have been learnt.
Since the fire, Ballymore have now committed to covering the remaining costs of removing the cladding on your building, haven't they?
Yes. Yeah. For us, yes. But that sets a very dangerous precedent, doesn't it? I mean, should it really take a fire and people almost losing their lives before developers do the right thing? It's just not good enough.
Coming up, after 4 years of reporting on this story, Rob reflects on what he thinks needs to happen to bring this crisis to an end. Rob, this is such a difficult issue. The government says they are helping leaseholders. Leaseholders say the costs and the responsibility of making their home safe is unfairly falling on them. Do you think a way will be found to ever fix this problem?
The bill that we've seen introduced this week suggests that nothing is changing from what we've seen over the last year or two, that the balance of power between the leaseholders and the freeholders and the developers is broadly going to remain similar. And so, sadly, for the leaseholders affected by this, it means that many of them are still going to be exposed to the same sorts of uncertainties, the same strains, the same financial strains, the same mental health strains, and the same fear, actually, that they're living in dangerous homes. And that's going to continue clearly for months to come.
This crisis has been going on for years now. Is it starting to have an impact on the housing market?
Well, we know it's frozen sales of lots of these flats, so they're not being transacted. But what it certainly does is it has a huge impact on the that the population which owns these flats would typically be quite mobile, you know, people in their 30s, 40s, maybe 20s too, selling, moving on, having families. It's kind of frozen their lives, and it's frozen that part of the housing market.
Finally, Rob, how do you reflect on how the Grenfell crisis has unfolded across the country in this way over the last few years?
Well, it's been devastating for the Grenfell families to watch hundreds of thousands of other people fear the same thing that happened to them, basically. You know, they have been warning, as they put it, that Grenfell 2 is in the post. And while this whole cladding crisis and building safety crisis remains unresolved, they just feel that there hasn't been justice for what happened to them. You know, they've made solving this problem or helping solve this problem one of their sort of campaign aims, really, the Grenfell families. And I mean, they watch the public inquiry and they know that what happened at Grenfell with the way the builders and material manufacturers behaved and passed the buck, that that wasn't a one-off. And I think finally, they think that it's, and they're probably right, that it's just been luck so far that there haven't been more deaths as a result of this crisis.
Natalie, how do you feel about your flat now?
It's just bittersweet, really. I have to leave. Once the work is done and the ACM cladding has been removed and the timber balconies have been removed, I still can't afford to live here as a leaseholder with service charges going up 53% in 4 years. And, you know, I haven't slept a single night since the fire. So I just, even once the work has been done, I need to get out. I don't feel safe here. I'm not happy here. Home is where you should feel safe. And this is just a constant source of stress. So no, I won't be staying, and I will never be a leaseholder again.
Natalie, thank you so much for speaking to me. That was Natalie Carter and Rob Booth. Rob has been covering this story for many years and has done some excellent in-depth reporting. Find all his work at theguardian.com. In response to some of the issues raised in this episode, a spokesperson for Ballymore said, "Ballymore is fully committed to supporting our leaseholders. We decided in February to establish a £15 million fund to bridge the shortfall between the cost of cladding remediation works and the provision of government funds. We've since enhanced this fund to £20 million. Cladding removal works at New Providence Wharf building are underway and will be completed at zero cost to leaseholders." Ballymore recently commissioned an independent third-party review of service charges across our London estate. It found that Ballymore service charges are competitive, represent good value for money, and are, in the vast majority of schemes, in line with or better than market comparables. Thanks to Natalie and Rob for speaking to me today. This episode was produced by Alex Atack. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Archie Bland. We'll be back tomorrow.